My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Big news! The sale of the season is here. It's Wayfair's Black Friday sale, and it's on now. Right now, get up to 80% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. And with amazing doorbuster deals from November 27th through December 2nd, you can shop the things you love at even lower prices at Wayfair. Plus, you can sit back and relax with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping. Everything home comes straight to your home. And the best part? Free delivery just in time for the holidays. This Black Friday, Wayfair deals are bigger and better than ever. There's no place like home for the holidays. And no place like Wayfair for Black Friday savings. So don't wait. Black Friday ends soon. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now and save up to 80% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
What would you do to get out of a bad situation? How far would you go to escape from unpleasant circumstances? What if those circumstances were of your own making? And what if your life just became a series of escapes and avoidances, each making your original bad situation seem less bad? When does walking away feel impossible? And what are the alternatives? Sometimes death might feel like the only escape, but what if you don't actually want to die? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. Some years ago, I wrote a story about a C-list Hollywood starlet who faked her own death in order to drum up interest in her again. But then, of course, once the spotlight was on her in death, she had to figure out a way to come back so she could actually partake in her newfound fame. It may surprise you to hear that I have never seen Gone Girl, though I have watched the Netflix documentary about the real-life Gone Girl, and I've certainly caught myself daydreaming from time to time about figuring out a way to disappear from my own life. Only for a while, though. Like the meme that says something like, "A coma sounds like a really nice break, TBH." Please, if you or someone you know is in a coma, don't be offended. Obviously, no one actually wants to be in a coma. We're all just trying to find ways to do a little chuckle once in a while. Gone Girl is actually a much more appropriate movie to reference when talking about Amy Semple McPherson than Thelma and Louise. I don't know what I was thinking way back then last week when I said all that stuff about Thelma and Louise. What is wrong with me? That's a rhetorical question. Please don't DM me with your armchair diagnoses. Though I stand by the analysis that Amy, like Thelma and Louise, may have felt desperate to escape her own life and may have taken drastic measures to do so. Let's recap real quick. Amy Semple McPherson really pounded the pavement in the beginning of the 20th century all across these United States to build up her brand and her church. She was the first really famous female preacher and founded the first megachurch, the Four Square Church in Angelus Temple, which she built from the ground up, literally and figuratively, through her truly tireless work as a traveling preacher. Her mother, Minnie, forever in her corner, ran the business side of the church, and by 1926, the pair was incredibly successful, though they lived frugally, by all accounts. By then, Amy was once widowed and once divorced, and had been living uncoupled romantically since her divorce some years ago. She was, for all intents and purposes, married to God. The temple was a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week operation, with a Sunday school, a full staff, a nationally distributed magazine called Bridal Call, and a radio station. Amy was the first woman to receive an FCC license and thousands of congregants. She had also gathered a couple of enemies along the way, though. Mostly the leaders of Los Angeles's extensive seedy underbelly and the lawmen who protected them, not to mention some male preachers who couldn't stomach the idea of a woman preacher, especially not one so much more popular than any of them could ever hope to be. On May 18, 1926, Amy Semple McPherson went swimming in Venice Beach, California, and seemingly blooped right out of the ocean and out of existence. For 3 weeks, thousands of faithful mourned the loss, and Minnie had introduced Amy's 16-year-old daughter, Roberta, as Amy's successor at Angelus Temple, a role that would be overwhelming for anyone, I imagine, let alone a child. But Roberta understood her place and stood ready to fill the void left behind by her mother's sudden absence. At the end of May, Herman Klein, the chief of detectives at the LAPD, told Minnie that a lawyer named R.A. McKinley came to them, saying he'd been approached by two men at his office in Long Beach. The men said they were holding Amy for a $500,000 ransom and wanted McKinley to be their go-between with the LAPD. According to author and historian Claire Hoffman, from her terrific book, Sister, Sinner, The Miraculous Life and Mysterious Disappearance of Amy Semple McPherson, McKinley said the men had picked him because he was known to represent criminals and, perhaps, more importantly, he was blind. Incidentally, Long Beach is about a half hour south of Venice Beach. McKinley said the kidnappers wanted Minnie to provide them with questions only she would know the answer to. Chief Klein was like, this lawyer isn't the world's most reliable dude, but it might be worth putting some questions together just in case. The questions were, quote, 1. Describe the hammock at our home in Canada and where the home was. 2. Describe our dog and tell what his name was. 3. Describe the stove in our dining room. 4. Who was Wallace and what was his relationship to our family? End quote. On June 20th, someone handed Minnie a letter postmarked from Tucson claiming Amy was alive and driving them all insane with her infernal preaching. They claimed Amy refused to answer the questions because she said she'd rather die than put the church in financial peril. But, they said, they tricked her into answering two of the questions about the hammock and the black hound she had named Jip. The letter included what was said to be a lock of Amy's hair, which Minnie believed was authentic. It ended with a threat that if they didn't receive the ransom, Amy would be sold to, quote, Old Philippe of Mexico City, end quote. And then, on June 23rd, Amy suddenly appeared at the garden gate of a man in a small border town in Mexico, asking to use his telephone before passing out. At the hospital, once she'd been given some time to put on some makeup and do her hair, Amy entertained a throng of reporters with her incredible tale. She'd been kidnapped, held for ransom in a shack in the desert in Mexico, and escaped by her own wits and grit, walking for more than 20 miles through the desert to her freedom. It was truly a miracle. Well, actually. Very quickly, LAPD were like, Amy, you got some splaining to do. Have you ever taken a walk in a desert climate? The desert is hot, notoriously so. It's kind of its whole brand. Remember I covered the family that went on a walk near Silicon Valley and they all died, including their dog? That was fewer than 9 miles, and it was a loop. Amy said she wandered for more than 20 miles and somewhere between 11 and 17 hours through the Mexican desert before reaching the house where she collapsed, with no food or water. I once went on a 2-mile hike in the desert early in the morning in late winter with snacks and water, and by the time we made it back to our cars, we were very, very thirsty and hot and sweaty, not to mention really cranky. Amy seemed to be none of these things after her heroic trek through the desert. All she asked for was a telephone. Then again, she had God on her side, and I most definitely did not. Her clothes, of which there were several layers, including a corset, showed none of the usual things one might expect to see after such an ordeal. They were not particularly soiled with sweat stains, nor were there any of those sticky, brambly things you usually collect on your pant legs in the desert. Her black leather shoes were not only relatively clean, but the soles did not show the appropriate amount of wear and tear from a 20-mile walk. Indeed, their brand could still be easily read on the sole. Not only that, but the only noticeable flaw in the slipper was some grass stains, which was extra confusing considering that the terrain she'd crossed was completely devoid of grass. Her hair was tucked into a silk hairnet. Listen, I get that it was a different time and there was a different sense of decorum, but I don't care if you're the Queen of France. You're going to take off your corset a couple miles into a desert stroll. As someone who has worn a corset, let me tell you. It's remarkable her captors kept her in her corset for 3 weeks, tied to the floor, such as she was. Not to mention, she was wearing a bathing suit when she was abducted, so all her clothes would have had to have been provided by her kidnappers. Why on earth would they bother giving her a corset and black leather slippers? And a silk hairnet. Not to mention the leather wristwatch Amy wore in the hospital when the photographer showed up. It's hard to overstate what condition someone would be in having been through what Amy said she'd been through. In Quantum of Solace, when Bond leaves Mr. Green in the middle of the desert, he tosses him a can of motor oil and says,
"I bet you make it 20 miles before you consider drinking that."
And, spoiler alert, but when they find Mr. Green's body, they find motor oil in his stomach. But even Amy's mother, Minnie, was like, "Da fuck?" She said it wouldn't have been like Amy to just follow some stranger to their car. And then there were the alleged abductors. Amy's description of Rose, Steve, and the unnamed third man were pretty generic and vague, and the local sheriff in Arizona, J.F. McDonald, wrote in his notes, quote, "I thought possibly that as Mrs. McPherson is a public speaker and must have a considerable knowledge of English, that she would be very apt to remember their manners of speech and detect any slang expressions or grammatical errors committed by her abductors. She could give me no information along this line," end quote. Next, there was the issue of the shack in which Amy said she'd been kept. Amy happily led a search party out to where she said she thought she'd come from, but found nothing. There was a set of footprints that went in a circle, but it was noted that they started seemingly out of nowhere, as if she'd been dropped off there by a car. During the tour of the desert, Amy claimed not to need water at all, to prove, I guess, that she could have walked all that way without needing any. But as author Claire Hoffman points out, quote, "A reporter, however, slyly noted that Amy snuck back to her car after an hour and drank from a thermos of iced water with her mother," end quote. Los Angeles Assistant District Attorney Joseph Ryan's suspicions grew by the minute as he watched the weird and stiff reunion between Amy and her children, the way she lit up when the reporters showed up to her hospital room, the completely inexplicable hairnet and watch, and then on the train back to Los Angeles on a stop in the middle of the night in Tucson, a man got on the train and positively ID'd Amy as the woman he'd seen walking around Tucson a few days earlier. The man said it was either Amy or her twin sister, but also that he recognized Amy by her thick ankles, which I kind of want to call foul on because if the woman looked identical to Amy, then ankles, regardless of thickness, would hardly be the deciding factor, right? Amy, too, was caught up on the ankle remark, but only because it seems her pride was hurt, because for the next hour, she complained not that she'd been falsely identified, but that she'd been accused of having thick ankles. Anyway, as the train approached Los Angeles, Ryan said he saw Amy putting dark makeup under her eyes, and let's be honest, there's no reason someone would do that except to make themselves look sicker and more tired than they actually are. Unless they want people to believe they're sicker and more tired than they actually are. and what people might she be trying to look sicker and more tired for? Why the 50 to 100,000 people who came down to Central Station to greet the miraculous return of their leader? Officers from her church had to lift and carry her over the heads of the massive crowd to get her to the car. By now, enough suspicion had grown around her story that pretty much every crowd Amy encountered was asked who among them believed her and stood by her. She was starting to suggest that anyone who doubted her must be in on a plot against her. She praised those who believed in her as being faithful. Shortly after arriving back at the temple, she said this to the mass of followers gathered there, quote, "There is absolutely nothing which I wanted that my followers would not gladly give me. I am queen in my own kingdom, and I am not boasting when I say so. I can ask anything and get it," end quote. This quote sticks out to me because, like, what? Why did she say that? What does it mean? You got kidnapped, held for ransom for 3 weeks, escaped through the desert, obviously through some kind of divine intervention, and one of the first things you say to your followers is that they would give you anything you asked for? Amy's sermons were now all about her ordeal. The devil himself had a hand in the whole plot because Amy had saved thousands from the evils of alcohol and gambling. She had brought so many people to Jesus that she was a serious threat to the devil, and he saw his opportunity to put an end to Amy and her salvation train. She and her church performers put on a skit all about the temple versus the devil, and, as Hoffman wrote, quote, "her story was forbidding and frightening. She was the victim of a vast conspiracy, a martyr of prophetic proportions. In the coming days, she would compare herself to numerous biblical figures, Daniel, St. Stephen, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Peter. But there was one person whose story intersected with hers over and over. Jesus. Despite all her Christ-like qualities, Amy remained fixated on the disbelievers, shouting how absurd it was to disbelieve her," end quote. Two things about this. One, I had actually never heard Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego outside of the Beastie Boys song. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego! And two, does this language sound familiar at all? A powerful person is questioned about a claim, and their response is to liken themselves to a martyr and suggest that their doubt is unchristian? Or, say, unpatriotic? Just something to chew on. Or, for some of you, to get mad and DM me about. The press could not get enough of the story, with some asking Minnie about the more than $36,000 that had been collected as tribute to Amy when they thought she'd been kidnapped. According to Hoffman, she told a crowd at the temple that if they weren't happy that Amy had been returned to them, they were free to ask for their money back. And while Amy and Minnie were dining out on the story of Amy's escape, the men in power in LA were not thrilled that their city, which they wanted to be seen as the Wall Street of the West Coast, was being portrayed as a place where even the most famous woman in the world could be whisked off a public street and held for ransom under the threat of sex slavery. It wasn't exactly the image they wanted out there. And then, a week after Amy returned, the mayor of Agua Prieta, Presidente Ernesto Bubian, released a statement saying he'd already told Amy that the story of wandering through the desert to her freedom could not have been true. This was based on findings from the official investigation in the desert. The statement read, in part, quote, "Only one automobile had passed over the road. These tracks led to a wash slightly less than 3 miles east of Agua Prieta. The machine turned around and stopped. Footprints of a woman led from the automobile to the garita, a rural shelter near the side of the road. The tracks were followed around the garita and then into the shelter near the side of the road. The footprints showed that a woman had walked about 300 yards from the automobile to the shelter. Then the tracks returned to the automobile. Some distance from where Mrs. McPherson was first seen, the automobile again stopped and the woman's tracks again began. For 175 yards, they were followed by men to about the spot where Mrs. McPherson says she stopped and called for aid. Then the tracks leave and head toward Agua Prieta, where they were lost. They were the only tracks on the road where Mrs. McPherson says she was. I therefore believe they were her tracks. If she did make them, then she could not have been wandering around all over the desert here, but would have been the passenger in an automobile which drove her across the border and from which she got out and walked back, after having left the machine once before some few miles beyond. End quote. There was zero evidence of the shack, the kidnappers, or a 20-mile trek through the desert. And now, people were looking to the district attorney's office to do something about it. And so, on July 6th, D.A. Asa Kies called a grand jury to see if Amy should be brought to trial. That same day, another reliable witness came forward to say that he, too, had seen Amy walking around Mexico like nothing was wrong a few days before she reappeared. His friend seconded the sighting, and both men said that when she saw that they were looking at her, she ducked behind a car. The men also identified H.D. Hallenbeck, a handyman from the temple, as Amy's companion when they'd seen her. Hallenbeck, incidentally, had a ranch in Arizona. Another witness said they'd seen Hallenbeck buying a hat in Tucson around the same time. Amy treated her appearance at the grand jury like another press opportunity and said to reporters before walking in, quote, "I am like a lamb led to the slaughter." I mean, no, girl, you are like the subject of an investigation being led to the witness stand. Dial it down a notch. Amy refused to keep whatever happened in the grand jury trial confidential, claiming that not sharing everything with her congregants would be a betrayal of their trust. Kies, for some reason, agreed. As Hoffman wrote, quote, "His agreement to do away with secrecy and allow information to flow freely from the private grand jury room out into the world would transform the course of the hearing and both of their lives," end quote. Strangers, I urge you to get Hoffman's book and read it because she covers the details of the way this shit show unfolded in ways that I don't have time for. Plus, it's just a really good book. The prosecution's theory was that Angela's temple was in a financial pickle and the whole kidnapping schmagegi was just a hoax to raise money from worried supporters. Kies asked her about the wristwatch and was like, "You wore the wristwatch while swimming in the ocean?" And she was like, "I don't remember. Maybe I got it when I got back home." And he was like, "Well, that's weird, because I'm pretty sure I remember seeing it on you in the picture from the hospital in Arizona." And Amy was like, "Well, then I guess my mom brought it to me, bruh." Because that makes sense. You find out your daughter, who you thought was kidnapped and probably dead, is actually alive and you remember to bring her watch? Sure. But actually, I don't see the wristwatch on Amy's wrist in the picture from the hospital, so unless there are other pictures in which she's wearing it, I kind of don't know what this line of questioning was about. Like, couldn't her lawyers have just been like, "Here's the picture, where's the watch?" You can't just be like, "I seem to recall you were wearing a watch," and have that become a fact. Amy used the witness stand to portray herself as the innocent victim who was the target of people who had grown jealous and scared of her power and reach. And she said the juror's decision to stand with her would be the righteous decision. Indeed, she told her congregation that hers, and by extension theirs, was a fight against the devil himself. It was a fight against darkness and light, good and evil. And she likened herself to Jesus on the cross. It was a lot. Despite aligning themselves with the side of evil, people started coming out of the woodwork to say they'd seen Amy in various places in the time she was allegedly shackled to the floor in a shack in the Mexican desert. including people who saw her at Venice Beach the day of her disappearance, having a long and flirty-looking conversation with a man, riding away from the beach in the front of a blue sedan, and about a week and a half later in Salinas, 4 hours north of Los Angeles, getting into a blue sedan with a man with a limp. And this, stranger, is where I've chosen to tell you, mostly because I forgot to mention it before, that Kenneth Ormiston, Amy's radio engineer and the man some people at the church were worried Amy was a little too chummy with, and the man who, remember, happened to be inexplicably missing from the temple at the same time Amy was in Europe, where rumors were flying that she was spending time with a man, and the man whose wife showed up to file a missing person report for him, that guy? Yeah, he had a limp. For his part, rather than show up to testify, as he'd been compelled to do, he instead chose to send a telegram the day before he was set to appear, basically saying, "Nah, bro, I wasn't in any of those places witnesses said they saw me, and I don't know shit about fuck." Not a great look. When Minnie took the stand, Kyes grilled her on the temple's finances, which she claimed were just fine, and he confronted her about a church employee's claims that she'd seen Amy and Minnie fighting the day before Amy's disappearance. Amy allegedly challenged her mother to run the church herself if she was so unhappy with what Amy was doing. Another witness said she saw Minnie slap Amy during a heated quarrel. Minnie denied the claim, saying her relationship with Amy was a good one, that they supported each other, and that Minnie was bossy in order to keep her daughter out of trouble. After 2 weeks of testimony, DA Kyes knew there wasn't enough evidence to indict Amy, and frankly, he didn't really want to have to bring arguably the world's most famous preacher to trial. Instead, he asked the jury to vote on indicting the kidnappers, which he had to know they wouldn't do, because not only was there not enough evidence that Amy was or wasn't kidnapped, but there were no actual kidnappers to indict. Perhaps he just wanted to scare Amy into dropping the whole thing. Indeed, the jurors voted not to indict the absent kidnappers. The jury foreman made a statement to the press saying the jurors would be happy to entertain any further evidence if Amy found any. And so, what Kyes hoped was the end of the whole affair, Amy only saw as the beginning.
Extra value meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
While most people in Amy's position might have considered the grand jury decision a victory, what with the whole there not being enough evidence to charge her with a hoax, Amy was not satisfied. It wasn't enough that she wasn't charged. The fact that her kidnappers wouldn't be charged was, in her opinion, further proof that there was some vast plot against her. But just 2 days later, the police chief from a town called Carmel by the Sea, a picturesque getaway about 5 hours north of Los Angeles, called Asa Kyes to say word was getting around their small town that Amy Semple McPherson had spent 10 days of the 3 weeks during which she was missing right there in a very private cottage. And she wasn't alone. Her companion, the man who'd made the arrangements to rent the cottage beginning on May 18th, the day Amy went missing, was a man with a pronounced limp. In the inimitable words of Scooby-Doo, strangers, rut-row. The man called himself George McIntyre. Henry C. Benedict, whose cottage George was renting, said he met whom he assumed was Mrs. McIntyre the next day. She wore a large hat and black goggles. You know, like you do. Benedict claimed to have seen a woman's green bathing suit hanging on the line. The McIntyres left suddenly on May 29th, citing a family emergency back east. ADA Joseph Ryan came to Carmel to interview the several witnesses who'd claimed to see the pair during their 10-day stay. Each one identified Kenneth Ormiston from a photograph as the man calling himself George McIntyre. After his brief investigation in Carmel, during which Ryan found a few items the McIntyres had left behind, he told reporters, quote, "I am fully satisfied now that Kenneth Ormiston and Amy McPherson occupied the beach cottage for nearly 10 days," end quote. And then, when Amy refused to travel to Carmel by the Sea at the DA's request in order to be identified by eyewitnesses, the LA Times ran this headline, quote, "Chief of Detectives Klein says mystery of McPherson case solved," end quote. The papers were rabid in their coverage of the discovery of the so-called Love Shack, plastering their front pages with pictures of Amy and Ormiston. Over at Trinity Church in Los Angeles, preacher Bob Schuller, one of Amy's loudest critics, called Amy's fake kidnapping story an outrage against Christianity itself. Amy gave a statement to the Associated Press accusing Ormiston of being in on the plot, receiving large sums of money to drive around all over the place with an Amy lookalike. She then accused Klein and Ryan from the DA's office of having a vendetta against her because, wait for it, they were Catholics. According to Hoffman, quote, "The Vatican," Amy all but said, "was behind her persecution, and the prosecution's office and the police department were puppets of the Pope, hell-bent on destroying the one true gospel, hers," end quote. This accusation may seem like it came out of nowhere, but at the time in the country, many immigrants coming from poor countries were Catholic, and as we've seen time and time again, when a powerful person is in danger or questioned, they find a way to blame the less powerful, often acting on people's unfounded fears and biases to whip up a distraction. By July 29th, Chief Ryan was in possession of a smoking gun in the form of a telegram sent by Ormiston from Los Angeles on May 28th. When Minnie had insisted he come speak to police during Amy's absence. The telegram simply read, quote, "Lease expires tonight." It was sent to the cottage in Carmel and signed for by a woman the delivery boy positively ID'd as Amy. It was only a few hours after the telegram arrived that a witness saw them in Salinas in the blue sedan. Joseph Ryan was like a dog with a bone, absolutely dead set on exposing Amy for what he thought she was, quote, "a fake and a hypocrite." But his boss, Asa Kies, was worried that going after Amy would cost him his seat in the next election. So the next time you catch yourself asking why I'm always bringing up politics, just know that Asa Kies is only one of countless who have weighed the pros and cons of a case against their own political ambitions. Publicly, of course, Kies couldn't be like, "I want to keep my seat." So he said the reason for not wanting to pursue the case was that it would cost the county thousands of dollars. He cast doubt on the evidence and witnesses they'd collected in their Carmel investigation and told the press he was pretty sure the whole thing would be ancient history soon enough. But then, months after he'd been asked and refused to speak to the grand jury, Kenneth Ormiston finally came forward with a whole new subplot. Yes, Ormiston told police, "I was in Carmel by the Sea with a woman, but it wasn't Amy. It was someone else whose name I'm not going to give on account of I want to protect her identity, even though she's literally the only person who could corroborate, because that makes sense. So I'll just call her Miss X and you'll all just have to take my word for it, okay?" His excuse for why he'd sent the telegram saying lease expires tonight is that he figured he'd be followed by law enforcement trying to catch him with Amy. Nothing he offered really made any actual sense, and the DA's office agreed, or at least Assistant DA Ryan agreed. As far as Ryan was concerned, Amy's kidnapping story was completely made up in order to either cover up her affair with Ormiston or just to get her name in the papers. And despite Asa Kies' effort to put the whole thing to bed, the grand jury came back, demanding to see the new evidence collected in Carmel. There were eyewitness statements as well as samples of handwriting that experts agreed matched Amy's found at the cottage where the pair allegedly stayed. And as if things weren't messy enough, one juror actually took the paper evidence with the handwriting on it and flushed it down the toilet in an effort to protect Amy. Minnie was implicated by some who thought she must have been in on the hoax all along. She unequivocally insisted she was not. On August 26th, Russell McKinley, the blind lawyer and only person besides Amy who had contact with the alleged kidnappers, was found drowned in a ditch in Long Beach after an apparent car accident. With him were two other men, friends of McKinley's, also drowned. Strangers, this whole thing was fully off the rails now. You had a rabid and relentless ADA under a DA who wanted to put the whole thing to bed. Three people connected to the case were dead, and the woman at the center of it was portraying herself as a martyr for all of Christianity to her thousands of followers all across the country. And then, Asa, I just want this whole thing to go away, Kyes, received a telegram from someone claiming their sister was indeed Mrs. George McIntyre, and she was the woman at the cottage in Carmel by the Sea. A few hours later, very late at night, back at the Temple Parsonage, a woman who identified herself as Mrs. Lorraine Wiseman Sylaff showed up with a cockamamie story that her sister and Kenneth Ormiston had been having an affair and were actually in Carmel to get an illegal abortion. She brought her story to Kyes, but refused to give any real identifying information, and Kyes was basically like, kindest wishes, warmest regards, here's the door. But Amy's lawyers insisted he give Lorraine the time of day, so Kyes took her to see Benedict, the man the pair had rented the cottage from in Carmel. Fun side note, Benedict had checked himself into a sanitarium after suffering a nervous breakdown from all the police and reporters who trampled through his home. He asked her to identify details about the cottage, which she couldn't do. But while the prosecution side had their doubts, Amy was becoming BFFs with Lorraine, spending an awful lot of time with her, even bringing her to stay at a congregant's beach house where she had Lorraine act out witness accounts of the woman who was definitely not Amy in Carmel. I guess Lorraine looked a lot like Amy, and even though she said it was her sister who'd been the one at the cottage, Amy was maybe trying to show how easily people could mistake someone for her. Listen, everyone seemed to have lost their minds by this point. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times called Lorraine and was like, "Hey girl, we want to hear your side of the story. We totes believe you." But then when she showed up there, they had 11 witnesses who said she was a scam artist and a liar. The paper had found out that she was not a legal secretary as she had claimed, but was, quote, an occasional seamstress, a deadbeat mother, and a petty criminal who had been living in downtown Los Angeles for months, end quote. And bank records proved she was in Los Angeles at the time she claimed to be in Carmel helping her sister procure an abortion. Lorraine, it turned out, was a woman named Villa Mae McDonald Wiseman Sylaff, who was wanted for writing bad checks. She was arrested. Police had found an expense account ledger in her bag with Amy and Minnie's names and the name A.M. Waters. When reporters tracked that guy down, he said he had nothing to do with any of it, but by morning, he had killed himself with poison. And despite his assertion that he had nothing to do with the whole affair, there were correspondences in his garbage can from Kenneth Ormiston's parents and another key player asking him to help them find Miss X. If your flabbers aren't gasted by now, I don't know what more you need. Lorraine asked Amy for the $3,000 bail, which Minnie refused despite receiving increasingly threatening notes from her throughout the night. But the examiner did pay her bail just to bring her to their offices, where they presented her with her fucking twin sister, Verla Kimball, who was like, oh yeah, this bitch crazy. She said her sister had suffered a head injury 15 years earlier and had gotten increasingly unstable ever since. At this, Lorraine turned around and was like, yeah, this whole thing was Amy's idea. She and Minnie have been paying all my expenses over the last 6 weeks while they dressed me up like Amy and had me practice her handwriting. And then, the late blind attorney Russell McKinley's secretary told reporters that she and McKinley had dressed up a friend, darkened his skin with makeup, and put a fedora on his head before taking a picture. When they showed the picture to Amy, saying they thought he might have been one of her captors, she declared, "It's him." At this, the secretary said they became convinced there were no captors and no kidnapping. She also added that neither she nor McKinley believed Minnie had any knowledge of Amy's plan. By now, Asa Kies had slipped into alcoholism, and Amy was running around saying she would gladly go to the electric chair in defense of her innocence and for all of Christian kind. You know, like Jesus went to the cross. But Kies asked Amy and Minnie to come to his office for a private meeting to quietly resolve the whole thing. I honestly don't know what kind of resolution he was hoping for, because Amy refused to show up and instead continued to paint herself as the hapless victim of a vast conspiracy. She even had the gall to call herself and her mother silly gooses, which, as a certified silly goose, I highly object to. And so, Kies, who had taken ADA Ryan off the case because he was too gung-ho about it, was forced to file charges against Amy, Minnie, Lorraine, and Ormiston. This would be a bench trial without a jury. The judge would decide whether or not to bring the defendant to trial. Kies issued a statement which ended with, quote, "Mrs. McPherson returned home after a month's absence with a story that she had been kidnapped and held prisoner in a shack by Steve and Rose, whom we now know to be purely mythical. This office has its duty to perform and must do it regardless of who is hurt. I am sorry for Mrs. McPherson, but that cannot influence my sworn duty," end quote. Which is crazy because he wanted to drop the whole thing months earlier. But here's the thing. Amy had backed herself into a serious corner. If she admitted the whole thing was a hoax, she would be admitting to lying to her followers. All their time and support and money donated would have been for nothing. Then she would have to admit she was off-stupping a married man. It is this podcaster's opinion that she absolutely made up the whole thing. Short of traveling back in time to undo it all, what could Amy possibly do at this point? And rather than take a deep breath and admit to the whole thing, she quadrupled down, asking her congregants to donate $1,000 each toward her defense fund, which was about a fifth of the average person's yearly income in those days. Most of her followers couldn't afford that kind of donation, but they could spend their time sending death threats to Amy's former lawyer, whom they claimed didn't do a good enough job defending her. The prosecution laid out all its evidence, including, once again, the assertion that Amy was recognizable by her thick ankles. At one point, Amy collapsed and had to be carried out. She claimed someone had intentionally poisoned her with a pin on her courtroom chair, and she developed gangrene from it. Meanwhile, Ormiston just didn't show up. Again. He was now completely MIA, until the last week of October, when investigators found him at a cheap hotel in New York City. He'd been there a month using the name Ralph Stringer, and while he was gone by the time police arrived, he'd left behind a trunk. Look, if you were watching this on a soap opera or something, you'd be like, give me an actual break, this is ridiculous. The trunk, as Claire Hoffman describes it, was filled with, quote, "silk gowns, lingerie, all in Amy's size, 38. The trunk held a dress from Amy's favorite dress shop, a flannel sports blouse tagged by a Carmel dry cleaner, and a pair of black slippers from a small Los Angeles boutique where Amy maintained an account," end quote. In addition to the clothing, investigators also found love letters with damning language about putting up a noble fight, signed by, quote, "your own darling woman that's always yours," end quote, and postmarked from Los Angeles. When a reporter confronted Amy about Ralph Stringer, he claimed Amy went pale and dug her nails so hard into her own palms that she bled. So, kinda inevitably, the judge ordered a proper trial for Amy, Minnie, and Ormiston. But on the day Asa Kies was supposed to file for a new trial, he dropped the charges. I'm exhausted. Are you exhausted? Basically, it came down to Lorraine, who was now a witness for the prosecution. She was too unreliable. Why he was hanging the entire case on Lorraine when there seems to have been a mountain of evidence against Amy, I don't know. So Kies dropped the charges, but made a statement to the press basically saying, look, she did it, okay? We just can't prove it. Strangers, Claire Hoffman's book has a whole third part that covers Amy's life after the trial, and let me tell you, I could do a whole nother episode, but I urge you to go out and get the book. There are so many more details that I didn't have time to cover. Evidence of blackmail and bribery, offers to make movies, an all-nighter with Charlie Chaplin, a third marriage and divorce, and an epic falling out between Amy and her most loyal follower, her mother Minnie. After years of trying to corral Amy and keep her on the righteous path to which she'd promised her as a baby, Minnie couldn't take it anymore. Her daughter's ego, it seemed, had soared well beyond the temple ceiling. Amy felt vindicated when the charges were finally dropped against her, and now she was unstoppable. Unfortunately, without her mother's even-tempered guidance, Amy nearly ran herself and her church into an abyss. I went into this book thinking of Amy Semple McPherson as a feminist icon, a trailblazer. She did what no one else had done before her. Her original message was one of love and forgiveness, and she used that message to build an empire from nothing. But the deeper into her story I got, the more I kept thinking of a certain leader we all know. She got in over her head, started believing her own hype, and created such a shitstorm around her to distract her from troubles that she dragged herself and her people down to nearly complete destruction. Look, Amy needed a break. That's it. I get it. I mean, I'm no leader of a megachurch, but I get the demands of constantly trying to grow and achieve the next level. Amy, like so many of us, had too much on her plate. She'd put herself in an impossible position. No one is infallible. Imagine what it would be like if we let our leaders make a mistake and then own it and vow to do better. Sure, she should not have gotten involved with a married man, but, like, she was lonely. She was a woman at the height of her success and her sexual prowess, probably. Don't you think even her most ardent followers would have understood if she'd gotten a boyfriend and said, listen, y'all, I'm so tired. I need a break. I'm going to go away for a month or so, and I'm taking this dude with me, and have a nice day. LOL. Who am I kidding? Sorry. I must have been thinking about an alternate universe. Sometimes I think about running off into the woods and disappearing. I imagine coming back might be a little tricky. Maybe I could be like, guys, I was kidnapped by some trolls. It was awful, but I'm back now. And there would be all kinds of Reddit threads about how I don't respect my audience enough to continue producing content at all costs. Weird how some people can be so hostile toward a person who gives them free entertainment. Amy Semple McPherson worked so hard to build her dream. She literally crisscrossed the country and built a massive following, one person at a time. She made people feel loved and welcomed and healed and saved. But ultimately, the pressure was just too much. The demands on her that she helped create were overwhelming. She portrayed herself as a saint, perhaps without truly thinking about what living like a saint would actually mean. She was a human woman with human needs who'd been placed on a pedestal of her own design and ultimately dug herself into a hole from which there was no good escape. Amy was not the first woman to look around at her life and go, this ain't it. But I'm pretty sure she was the first woman on record to gone girl herself. But in the process of extricating herself from the pressures of her life, she forged a Byzantine web of complications that only served to tighten the ropes she felt were binding her. How does a situation get so far out of hand that you can't just say no thank you and walk away from it, but rather find that you have to create a bizarre Rube Goldberg mechanism to leave it? Maybe what Amy did was understandable. Isn't it human nature that when we build something, even if it feels like a prison, we have a hard time just walking away? Maybe we can't just undo all we have wrought, and so we come up with ways to get around tearing it all down, hoping that our emerging needs won't harm our legacy. Or maybe Amy simply lacked accountability. She wanted to have her cake and eat it too. She wanted to be a savior and a prophet and have the admiration and devotion of her followers, but she also wanted to be free of any responsibility to them or anyone else. She wanted to move freely between the trappings of fame and the peace of quiet anonymity. And she had the arrogance to think she'd found a way to do that. She had the kind of outsized confidence that comes with fame and high-level success that could lead someone to believe they are clever enough to fool everyone. Amy Semple McPherson may not have been the feminist icon I believed she was, but she was a woman living an extraordinary life and doing extraordinary things. She was, first and foremost, a flawed human being who made good and bad choices, and who was mostly guilty of having ambition and wanting to be free in a world that continued to try to make her conform to the roles assigned to her. And that, stranger, in spite of her unusual trajectory, makes her completely relatable. Next time on Strange and Unexplained. When you think of the people who inhabited this continent before the Europeans came to colonize, you likely think of the various nations of non-white people we used to refer to as Indians. But legend has it that a group of nocturnal, pale, tiny, Welsh-speaking people called the Appalachians their home even before the Cherokee or the Creek, the Moon-Eyed people. This episode was researched and written by me, Daisy Egan. My primary source was Claire Hoffman's terrific book, Sister Sinner. Sound engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at GrabBag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and GrabBag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange. Mm-hmm.